Welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast, where we collect the best of our movie coverage for the week. This week, just in time for the home stretch of the nation's political season, a profile of a fictional politician, new technology that will make copying DVDs easier, theaters look beyond movies to fill seats, and a documentary about studio musicians who are part of your musical past. But first up, a film about a young girl who takes control of her destiny.
Back now with Day to Day, and a listener caution here, this next segment does contain language some people are going to find offensive.
Alan Ball is the creator of the critically acclaimed TV series 6 Feet Under. He also wrote the screenplay for the movie American Beauty. He has another TV show and another movie out now. The TV show is about vampires. It's called True Blood, and it debuts this Sunday on HBO. And the movie is called Towelhead. It opens next week. Alan Ball is here with me in our Culver City studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, let's talk first about Towelhead.
Okay.
This is about a 13-year-old girl named Jazeera, who is of Middle Eastern descent, and she goes to live with her strict Lebanese father in Houston.
During the first Gulf War.
During the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. What do you say when people ask you, what is this movie about?
You know, I believe it's a real story of empowerment. Between being on the receiving end of racism and being on the receiving end of totally inappropriate attention by an older man, Jazeera, sort of just through the sheer power of her own strength and her own spirit, she comes out on the other side of this experience, really being in control of her body and her destiny for the first time. And as I've survived traumatic experience of my own, I thought that was a really, really powerful message.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when I was 13 years old, my sister was killed in a car accident in front of my eyes, and that certainly changed my life. What happens to Jazeera with Mr. Voso certainly resonates with me personally. I don't want to get into the details, but it's one of the reasons that that's a thematic area in my work. And I do believe that for such a common experience, I don't think it always results in a life of being a victim.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the movie where she meets her neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a little clip.
Your father let you wear makeup? How old are you?
13.
Wow. Wow, you look older.
I think what I found interesting about your movie and your portrayal of Jazeera and this older neighbor is that she really doesn't understand how she feels about him. She is attracted to him and scared and repulsed and drawn, and it's very complicated. And he as well, he's not just pure evil.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, Jazeera is trapped in a very sterile life. Both her parents are raging narcissists. She is belittled by the students at school because of her ethnicity. She really has no power or no pleasure in her life. And so the attention that he gives her makes her feel special. Obviously, she's going to go there. She doesn't have an adult perspective to realize what's going on and where it's leading up to. He, on the other hand, is very similar in a lot of ways. He's trapped in a life that is devoid of anything that makes him feel really valid or special, and his interactions with her take him back to a time when life was really exciting and the world was his oyster, so to speak. But he is an adult. He knows better.
Where do the themes overlap with her being of foreign extraction from the Middle East in the middle of America? Mm-hmm. Where does that overlap with the story of child sexual abuse?
Well, I think they're both instances of objectification. In a lot of ways, we're all towelhead of some sort or another to somebody else because of who we are.
Now, the title has gotten some criticism from...
Of course.
The Council on American-Islam Relations,
right.
CARE.
Right.
They've come out and said, please change the title. We think
yes.
It's insulting. We don't like it. I know it's the title of the book you based the movie on. Did you think, maybe I should change it, or no, I'm not going to?
I did change the title at the beginning because the movie was independently financed, and I thought nobody's going to buy a movie called Towelhead, even though I think that's the title that the author chose. She herself is Arab-American. And then when Warner Independent bought the movie, they said, you have to change the title of the movie that you have right now, which was Nothing is Private, which is a really horrible title. We spent days combing lists of possible titles. And eventually I just thought, you know, the title of the book is Towelhead. And the best title for this story is Towelhead. It is offensive. It's hate language. That's the point.
Long time no see, Towelhead.
Don't call me that.
Okay. Camel jockey.
Shut up.
Okay. Sand. Ow! You're in big trouble, Talhead!
You're openly gay. What if there were a movie out made by someone else called The F Word?
Faggot.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. You said it.
Even if I didn't like it, I would support that person's right to call that movie that. I don't think it's the word itself. It's the context in which it's used. And ultimately, we have to disempower these words anyway.
This theme that you're talking about in Talhead of disenfranchised groups mm-hmm. of people and marginalization, this provides me with a great segue to talk about your TV mm-hmm. series, True Blood, which mm-hmm. is about vampires. Talk about outsiders, mm-hmm. the undead. Did you purposefully have this theme in mind when you thought about this series?
I don't think that way. I don't think in a sort of cerebral academic way when I work. It's much more organic. When I read Charlene Harris's novels on which the series is based, I thought that was so entertaining and clever, and yet at the same time it didn't feel didactic or preachy because it was vampires. You can't really take it that seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tongue-in-cheek. You have vampires going on TV, you know, asking for their rights.
Number one, show me documentation. Doesn't exist. Number two, doesn't your race have a history of exploitation? We never owned slaves, Bill, or detonated nuclear weapons. And most importantly, point number three, now that the Japanese have perfected synthetic blood, which satisfies all of our nutritional needs, there is no reason for anyone to fear us.
Yeah, it is tongue-in-cheek, absolutely. There's an anti-vampire church. They show up and they hold signs that say God hates fangs. And it is tongue-in-cheek, but it's fun. It's clever.
And it's full of sex.
It's very sexy.
Vampires have always been a metaphor for sex, right?
Absolutely. I have discovered since reading Charlene's books that there is a whole market for vampire romantic fiction. And I'll admit it, there's a lot of sex and violence in this show.
And obviously theme of death, which yep. is 6 feet under,
yep.
taking place in a funeral home.
Yes, sex and death.
Sex and death, two great themes in the American novel and elsewhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, well, Alan Ball, thank you very much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Alan Ball is the creator of True Blood. It's a series on HBO which debuts this Sunday. He's also the director of the new film Towelhead. It opens next week.
And now a profile of one of America's greatest and most controversial politicians. Willie Stark was a champion of the little guy who became a governor and a tyrant. He's also fictional. Stark began life in print, the main character of Robert Penn Warren's classic novel, All the King's Men. Stark has since been the subject of two movies, three stage plays, and an opera. He resembles the legendary Huey Long of Louisiana, but Stark's persona is larger than any one man. As part of our continuing In Character series, NPR's Ron Elving has this look at the quintessential American demagogue.
We want Willie!
In each retelling, the story of Willie Stark reaches its climax with a vote on his impeachment as governor. A throng of his supporters waits outside the state capitol.
This is the result. Willie Stark has won!
Surrounded by bodyguards and police, Willie Stark appears on the steps of the Capitol.
Do you like what I have done?
And what has Willie done? He's won elections as an outsider and smashed the old power structure in the Capitol. He's built roads and bridges, hospitals and schools, and he's eliminated every rival for power and every competing authority. Now he wants to run for president. But at this moment, an assassin steps from the shadows. Willie Stark was the creation of the American poet Robert Penn Warren, who also wrote fiction. All the King's Men was his best-known novel, winning the Pulitzer Prize for 1946 and becoming a hit movie. Willie Stark's story is the classic cautionary tale of power and corruption, a small-town crusader who rides a wave of depression anger all the way to the governor's office.
But I am going to tell you a story. It's about a hick. A hick like you, if you please. Yeah, like you. He grew up on the dirt roads and the gully washes of a farm. He knew what it was to get up before dawn and get feed and slop and milk before breakfast and then set out before sunup and walk 6 miles to a one-room slab-sided schoolhouse.
Stark delivers on his promises, but his single-minded pursuit of power ultimately destroys him and all those around him. The film won several Oscars, and 60 years later, Willie Stark still seemed irresistible to another Oscar-winning actor with an interest in politics, Sean Penn. Here's his 2006 take on Willie Stark on the stump.
Lifelong truth, you are a hick, and ain't nobody never helped a hick but a hick yourself. It's up to you to nail these parasites up. Up to you and me and God.
Amen.
Nail up, Joe Harrison.
The author did not live to see the second film, but he would not have liked seeing his story set in Louisiana, nor would he have approved of having Sean Penn sing this song.
Every man a king, every man a king, though you can be a billionaire.
But there's something belonging to others. There's enough for all people to share.
That second singing voice is supposed to be that of Huey Long, who wrote that song while he was governor of Louisiana. Even today, you can hear him speak and sing in an animatronic version in the old state capitol building in Baton Rouge. Long was governor and then senator in the 1920s and 30s, inspiring fierce loyalty and even greater animosity, a legend for his denunciations of the wealthy.
There has been yielded too much to eat, too much to wear, everything to live in. The Lord has answered the prayer.
Long was at the zenith of his career, plotting a path to the White House when he was assassinated in 1935. Just a year earlier, Warren had begun teaching at LSU. So for many, Willie Stark is no more than a fictional gloss on Huey Long. But for Robert Penn Warren, Willie was not Huey Long, and the novel was not just about politics. Warren pointed out that his first version of Willie was sketched out on a sabbatical in Italy in 1938. At the time, he would say he was more concerned about another authoritarian figure, Benito Mussolini, who was one model for his earliest Willie Stark. Warren in Italy wrote a verse drama about a man named Talos, an allusion to a mythic Greek hero. As he converted that poetry into the prose of the novel, he renamed his character Willie Talos. His editor hated that name, so Warren suggested Willie Strong, which sounded too much like Long, and they compromised on the German word for strong, Stark. Years later, when opera composer Carlisle Floyd asked permission to base an opera on All the King's Men, Warren agreed, but would not let Floyd incorporate the tune Every Man a King. Floyd called his opera Willie Stark, even though it followed the novel's plot lines, including the assassination scene. David Madden is a writer, scholar, and teacher who took a job at LSU because Warren had been there. He's now the Robert Penn Warren Professor of English there.
The reason I teach and write about it as a universal book and try to stay off Huey Long is because I really do believe that it applies to America. Everybody in it, Willie Stark mainly, is representative of facets of the American experience.
Warren clearly regarded Willie Stark as both a Machiavelli and a kind of mouthpiece for moral philosophy. Yet for generations of readers, Willie Stark remains a political animal.
On a certain level, he's a forebearer of the kind of cynicism we have about politics today.
Alicia P. Long teaches history at LSU.
We just assume that politicians play hardball, that politicians today consider themselves an entitled class.
T. Wayne Parent is a professor who uses All the King's Men in his political science courses at LSU.
It's about the democratization of the United States, and Huey Long was a good model for what can go right and what can go wrong. But Willie Stark, I think, was imagined in an even broader, fuller, richer sense than Huey Long. And that's what makes that novel so fantastic.
Robert Penn Warren would have many honors in his long life, becoming America's first poet laureate in 1986. But nothing else he wrote found such an audience as All the King's Men. And for all of the poet's high art, his best remembered creation is his rough-hewn Willie Stark, the unlovely embodiment of our unfinished democracy. Ron Elving, NPR News.
Today, the digital media company Real Networks introduced a $30 software program called Real DVD. It lets you copy movies onto your computer hard drive. Ideal, says Real Networks, for traveling on business or entertaining the kids on a long trip without having to tote along the physical discs. But why would movie studios go along with this? Well, they probably won't. Brad Stone covers internet trends and consumer technology for the New York Times, and he's written about Real DVD. He joins us from San Francisco. And Brad, how would this work? What does it allow you to do?
Well, it actually sounds utterly conventional. We've been doing this with our CDs for a long time. You download a copy of the software from Real.com, and then you put your DVD in the computer, your copy of Star Wars or the first season of Lost, and it makes a copy. It copies the episodes, the movie or TV show. It copies all the extras, the bonuses, the previews. It even copies the art from the box, and then it puts it in the software, and you can tote it around on your computer. You can also send it to up to four other computers, but you've got to buy additional copies of the software.
And this only works on PCs, not on Macs. What can't this program do?
Well, you know, there are a lot of free, what they call DVD ripping software out there, with names like Handbrake, Mac the Ripper. Those are generally illegal. You can find them on the internet, and if you're a sophisticated computer user, you probably know where to look. And they let you make unlimited copies. Of course, they are illegal. Real Networks has built some restrictions into Real DVD to try and skate the legal line. They are only going to let you make five copies in all, and they're going to charge you for each version of the software you buy for every computer. And they pay licensing fees to a consortium called the DVD CCA, the Copy Control Association. That's a group of studios and consumer electronics companies that manages the encryption on DVDs.
I gather the way this is supposed to work is that you're only supposed to be copying DVDs you own legally, but there wouldn't be anything to keep you. If I went to Netflix and got a movie or rented one from my store or borrowed it from a friend, I could copy that onto my hard drive with Real DVD the way it's structured now, right?
Exactly. And the Hollywood studios have always feared that. They call it rent, rip, and return. You know, they worry that no one will ever buy a DVD again. And really, with the new software, Real DVD, there's nothing to stop it. I think they're counting on people to do the right thing and only make copies of DVDs they have purchased.
Well, what's Hollywood doing to try to stop Real DVD from flourishing in the marketplace?
Right. Well, they do have a long history of suing companies that have products like this. About 5 years ago, they sued a company called 321 Studios out of existence. And 2 years ago, they sued a company called Kaleidoscape. It made a $10,000 server that allowed anyone to make copies of all the movies they own and put it on one giant server connected to their TV. Well, they sued Kaleidoscape, and they actually lost that ruling in a California district court. And that created the legal opening that Real Networks believes allows them to produce the product Real DVD.
So Real Networks isn't worried about getting sued?
I think they are. I think they're right now sort of a marginal company in the digital media space, and I think they realize they need to get aggressive in offering people what they want and walking that fine line.
Would this program let you, once you've copied a DVD onto your hard drive, does it let you then, you know, if you don't want to watch it on your laptop, can you have it play on your nice 52-inch flat-screen TV?
Right. My understanding is you cannot, and certainly that will be a limitation for some people. My feeling is that Real Networks hopes to put a stake in the ground here, and if they don't get sued and if the product does prove successful, then they'll do that with future versions.
Brad Stone covers internet trends and consumer tech for the New York Times. Brad, thanks very much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Here's one way that your local movie theater may be trying to get you off the couch and back into the multiplex by showing something that you wouldn't normally think of as a movie. For example, a Broadway show. Tickets can cost north of $100 per person to see a big stage show in New York. But here is the multiplex alternative. Watch the same cast perform the same show on the screen at a movie theater for a fraction of the cost. Cyrus Farivar reports.
Rent has closed on Broadway, but it's coming to a movie theater near you. It's a film version of the Broadway finale. If Broadway musicals aren't your thing, how about some Cirque du Soleil? Cirque du Soleil showed Delirium on movie screens around the country for a few days last month. Mike Haniger of Berkeley, California saw the show. He says it's not the same as when he went to the performance of one of Cirque du Soleil's live shows, Ka.
It's not quite as good, but for the money. You know, Ka was $160 each. This was $20. I would do it again.
While Rent and Delirium are both recorded performances, this past summer, Drum Corps International showed its 5-hour quarterfinals competition live in theaters around the country. It's the top competition for marching bands. This year was the 5th time that the organization has shown its quarterfinal round on movie screens, says John DeNovi of Drum Corps International.
You get the sense of the sound and the image and the picture on the big screen. I also think what's exciting for our fans is that they get to enjoy it with other fans. If something happens on a screen you would normally cheer for in the stadium live, our fans will cheer at the screen just like they were sitting right there in the stadium with us.
Movie theaters are branching out because they need the money. They've now got to compete with home theaters, iTunes, pirated movies, Netflix, and other new rivals. Professor Tyler Cohen of George Mason University.
If they show a Hollywood movie and charge you $10 for the ticket, maybe the movie theater keeps a little more than a dollar of that figure. But if they charge you $18 for going to see the Metropolitan Opera, they keep much more of the money.
Cohen also points out that New York's Metropolitan Opera will have a whole new season of simulcasts of its performances, just like it did last year.
The number of viewers who saw the Met Opera's simulcasts was 920,000, and that's far more people than saw those same operas live. So this is now, all of a sudden, the main way that American people are experiencing opera.
The Parkway Theater in Oakland, California, has been screening TV shows like the Oscars and the Super Bowl for the past decade. The Parkway's Catherine Fisher says it's really popular.
Come be together, have food, have drink, relax, get to know your neighbor, talk about what's pertinent. But we're irreverent, so what's pertinent to us is the Oscars, the Super Bowl.
The Parkway will also be showing all of the presidential debates. And sports may also be moving onto the silver screen. Last year, the NBA experimented with showing the All-Star Game in 3D at a private event at a Las Vegas movie theater. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar.
Okay, every year the International Documentary Association screens documentaries in order to qualify them for Oscar consideration. Most of those films, though, will never be seen in a theater again. Day to Day's David Was says one of them deserves better.
It's a downright shame that distinguished films like The Wrecking Crew might never see wider distribution. The documentaries and insider's history of the gifted L.A. studio musicians who anonymously played on hundreds of hit records for 3 decades.
They were the stone-cold rock and roll professionals, and there may never, ever be a group of rock and roll musicians of that caliber again.
The handsomely produced documentary is the brainchild of Denny Tedesco, whose late guitar virtuoso father Tommy was one of the stalwarts of the Hollywood studio scene. Denny began to film his dad when he was diagnosed with cancer some 13 years ago, then expanded the concept by digging up rare archival footage and doing interviews with the likes of Brian Wilson, Jimmy Webb, and Herb Alpert.
The signature moment in Taste of Honey is when the bass drum is knocking four to the floor. We didn't have a way to get back to the time without, you know, a count off. And Hal, you know, said, let me hit the drum, the bass drum. Everyone will know when to come in.
The surviving members of the Wrecking Crew are all on hand as well. What emerges is a touching portrait of overqualified jazz musicians who initially grumbled about having to play on crap rock and roll records, but who eventually moved into big mansions and drove shiny Jaguars to their never-ending recording dates.
I didn't care for rock and roll that much. I was basically a jazz drummer. But I realized that I'm making my living off it. If I'm going to continue to do that, I got to play that like that's my favorite music. It's not beneath you if it's supporting you.
One of the clever production touches Tedesco employs is having the individual musicians play their instruments alone, then fading in the famous record that lick was a part of. Bass player Carol Kay, the only woman to join ranks with the crew, is recalled by Brian Wilson as being the greatest bass player in the world. Carol then plays the very notes Brian wrote for Good Vibrations, returning the compliment by saying, "You knew this kid was into something really, really great."
I'd have never played that.
I'll just go into this.
There are over 100 music cues in the film, which could have been a fiscal nightmare for the filmmaker had the various labels and publishers not bent over backwards to make this labor of love possible. Generally speaking, licensing big hit records can cost upward of $50,000 per song. The Wrecking Crew features a gaggle of such high-priced classics like Wichita Lineman.
I am a lineman for the county.
You've Lost That Love and Feeling.
You've lost that love and feeling, now it's gone, gone, gone.
And California Dreamin'.
All the leaves are brown.
By the end of the film, you'll be a believer. And yes, the crew were the faceless wizards behind the Monkees as well.
Day-to-day contributor David Was, half of the musical duo Was Not Was.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.